This is The Producers, a podcast. The biggest names in audio production, station sound, radio imaging, branding, and voiceover. Interviews, tips, tricks, advice. To be a part of the show, visit RyanOnTheRadio.com. Now, The Producers with Ryan Dreen.
Hey, here we are. Producers Podcast is back. We talk some radio imaging, radio voiceover, radio station production in general. Also, a lot of sound design, tools, tips, tricks, everything you need to produce up some audio. This is a guest I've been wanting to talk to for quite some time, and I had him requested. I reached out to him a long time ago, and I think we just had simply had a case of lost email, something like that. Anyway, reached out to him again, and man, he was excited to do the show, and I was excited to have him. Rick Allen, it was a great, great conversation. And as you'll notice, we couldn't stop talking. It went three parts. I think it's all really good content. I mean, I think it's really enjoyable. So hopefully it won't be like, oh man, that was long. I think you'll be like, wow, that was really entertaining, especially if you're a radio nerd, you're into any form of audio production. I think you're going to get a lot out of it. I'll just kind of roadmap what's going on here. Part one, we really spend most of the time on his background, kind of his history, where he's been, where Rick has been in his career. Spent a lot of time on his hot days, Hot 97 or Hot 103, Hot 97 in New York. And then, you know, get into some of the other projects he's worked on over the years. He's had, I can say he's in his fourth decade of radio production, radio work, audio production work. So yeah, he's just a great guy. A lot to talk about, the great storyteller. So anyway, part two, we get a little more into the current landscape of radio. We don't get too techie in part two, but we do get a little more present days. And we talk a little more about what else he's got going on currently at Rick Allen Creative. And then part three, we do get into the nerdery, as I like to call it. We talk some geek stuff, plugins, EQ settings. We talk about some of the real specific stuff that he's working on as far as sound design, some tools that he's offering up for other people to do their own sound design. So anyway, a lot of cool stuff that we go into. And I could really sit here and talk about it for a long time, so I won't do that. I will say, and I mentioned it multiple times throughout the interview, but the show notes page is definitely worth checking out. He actually spent a lot of time pulling together some really good content. Sent it over to me. I posted it in a nice little gallery with captions, with a ton of photos of him doing work, some screen caps, some other things there. A lot of cool stuff to look at. And then there's some links that he gave. His Facebook, so you can go connect there. His main website. Also, some cool stuff that he has sort of a, I don't know if they're hidden pages, but they're not really advertised pages on his site. So, pretty exclusive stuff to this podcast. So you want to be perusing the show notes as we go through the interview. It's funny, Robert Dudzik, who was a couple guests ago, he gets brought up, and still wanted to make mention. If you check out the new imaging I did for this podcast, I used Ann DeWig as a voice, and it's all Dudzik's Dave Fox signature sounds on here too. So just if you're curious, that intro that played there, and then the outro that'll come, the bed that I'm talking over. Anyway, it's just a small world. You can't really talk to one person without bringing up five others that you already, you know, it's just a small nepotistic world, this radio production thing we do. I kick off, let's see here, actually I'll make mention, part three, I'm going to start with the most updated. In fact, I assume he has it on his website by now, but it's his Climax product. It's been around a long time. A lot of stations are using it. Just updated the demo, so you'll hear that to kick off part three. But right now, we're going to go a little old school and kick off part one with Rick Allen with basically the Rick Allen retro montage. So thanks again for checking this out. I'll come back in, check in at the back end of part three, and tell you some future doings and links and stuff. All right, here we go, Rick Allen.
Rick Allen. From the top of the Empire State Building, 97.1 WQHT, New York. Hot 97.
Say Hot 97.
Hot 97.
Perfect, I like that. hip-hop.
Check it out.
Hot 97. 97.1!
What do you say?
Today's hottest music.
Hot 97, baby!
Hot 97 hooked up with MTV to pull the plug on Arrested Development. Plug on
Won't you let me?
Hot and free tickets to sit in on the live taping of MTV Unplugged with Arrested Development.
Can you say a little few words to the Hot 97 public out there?
A few little words to the Hot 97 public out there.
Check it out on Hot 97.
This is a recording.
Hot 97. Blah, blah, blah. MTV Video Music Awards. Blah, 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 blah. Keep listening to Hot 97 to win a free trip to L.A. and tickets to the show. Blah, 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 blah. Now, here comes the music.
Hot 97.
Say it like you mean it.
Hot 97.
Hot 97.
Rick Allen.
And that's we'll use the word retro, maybe classic, just great old school imaging from the one and only Rick Allen. Rick, man, thank you for taking the time for this interview. It's been a long time coming to get you on this podcast.
Ryan, thanks for having me. This is I love radio. I love listening to your podcast, put it together, and get a chance to be on the actual podcast. I'm fired up.
Yeah. Okay, so I have in front of me, and usually, you know, when I talk to somebody on one of these podcasts, I can keep most stuff in my head. I pretty much know where I want it to go. I know, you know, with this specific person, what I want to talk about. With you, I have a few pages here that I've typed up to try and keep my thoughts together, but there are about 1,000 things I think we could go over. You have your hands in a lot of different things. Before I get to your background, just give us a brief roadmap of what your world is like today, you know, the different things that make up your job today.
Well, radio is still the main focus for my business, but in fact, it's kind of neat. I had a really small part in the big Clear Channel national promotion. They got a hold of me, and on the QT, I created a whole mini production library for them to use, and that's airing on virtually every Clear Channel station.
Yeah.
And then Continuous Climax evolved into Climax Imaging, and that's still a solid production library that's going strong after 18 years. That has been an ongoing updated production library with close to 10,000 cuts in there now. So that's been and continues to be a really exciting thing for me. But it's also the technology has kind of given me a chance to take my love for audio in a lot of different directions. One of the things I've been having a blast doing is actually going out on location and doing multi-mic high-def recordings and gathering up crazy sounds to use
like
in sound
Foley?
Design. Yeah, well, not necessarily really true Foley sounds. I kind of like the term hyper-real instead of really realistic. If you think about it, when you're working on a radio spot and you're talking about a garbage truck, if you listen to some of the sound effects libraries out there, the garbage trucks that they record, hey, they sound real, but they don't evoke any emotion or bring or animate it a little bit. And radio needs that. It needs something bigger than life. And it's why I kind of use the term hyper-real.
Now, I like that. I've run into that. I'm sure a lot of people listening have run into that, where you're doing a spot where perhaps you want a trash truck, or maybe you want the sound of a bus, and you get bus from your sound effects library, and it doesn't print. And so now you're thinking, well, how the hell do I make a radio listener hear bus when a bus isn't doing it? So then perhaps you need some of that hyper-real sound like you do.
Well, a lot of it is, I had to learn the hard way. You go out and with a digital recorder, you just record something. And when you bring it back to the studio, it's like, huh? And
yeah.
One of the biggest examples that I can think of is when I started recording gunshots. And you, when you're out firing guns, it sounds huge. And you get that recording back to the studio. And sometimes it can sound like popcorn. I mean, it just sounds like nothing. And you really have to do your research on what microphone to use,
mm-hmm.
where to place it. And with guns, I actually, when I recorded a whole series of gunfire sounds, I used 7 different microphones as much as 75 feet away and as close as 2 feet away. And combining all those sounds makes a big difference. And even after that, there were times where I would take a snare drum or kick drum and add that into to the actual fire of the piece. So then when it's all done, you may have 20 tracks for just one gunshot.
So this is a good time for me to pause before we go. We're gonna go back in time here in a second, but pay attention, anyone listening that has enjoyed the show notes pages, that I think now I've had some great material sent in by some of the guests I've had, but you may have helped me create the best show notes companion page to any episode. And I think for right now, we have shots of you up there actually creating some of these gunshot sounds. A couple pictures up there for that. And then I believe you gave me a session, right? You actually gave me a session screen grab?
You've got a full Pro Tools session screen grab of just a basic sweeper session that I'll start with some plugins in there and that sort of thing. I put in a screen grab of a basic starting point for voiceover to have a voice cut through on a sweeper.
Yep.
That I like to start with. And then just a lot of crazy pictures of various recordings.
Yeah, this is, I think for right now at least, we've got about 19 or 20 pictures that are up. I also have a bunch of links. I'll get more into detail on what else is on the show notes page later on as I wrap up the episode. But for people that are listening along, if you want to go start checking that out, just hit the show notes page for the Rick Allen episode. So, okay, let's go back a little in time now. In fact, I've gotten to talk to you a little bit, sort of off the air, as it were, and I have a feeling you have a lot of stories. I say we start from the beginning, and then just bounce us through some of your, I don't know, your most favorite times in radio. But you know, starting with your first gig.
This is going to be a long one because I mean,
yeah, like, right.
I've been doing this for 37 years, and I got to tell you, every single day working in this business, I wouldn't take back. I'd do it again. I loved it. And I mean, there's been days where I've been close to just, you know, laying down and dying because I'm just exhausted because the PD wanted me to do just that much more. But I loved it and I did it. And it was for all the right reasons. It sounded good on the air. The PDs were right. I hate to admit it, but they were always right. But I started actually when I was 15 years old.
So you're one of those guys. I've decided there's basically only two types of radio people. The ones that start to think about a real job, they go to maybe college, like I did. I went to college and I got out and I realized, well, I can't do a real job. But then there's the others who basically start when they're somewhere between 13 and 16.
Yeah, well, and the funny thing is before my mom passed away years ago, I remember her asking me, are you ever going to get a real job where you have to wear a suit?
Right.
And I said, I certainly hope not. And
yeah,
so,
right.
And so far, I haven't had to. But the other funny part of that was another guy who was in high school with me was, his name was Mark Edwards. And he actually went on to program Light FM in Chicago. And he's been programming some major stations around the country. Well, he and I were 15 years old, no driver's license, got a gig at a small, tiny radio station at a small, tiny town outside of Indianapolis, about an hour's drive. And we had a weekend gig. We had to be there and sign on the station at 5 a.m., and we worked till noon. And our parents actually took turns carpooling us. And I look back going, man, I don't know any parent these days that would do it. I mean, I would have said, hey, wait till you're 16, buy a car and do it yourself. But that was really cool. It was a neat experience there. And
you were on the air, on-air gig?
Yep. I was embarrassed to say there probably are tapes in existence of air checks that I hope no one ever hears, because I love production for a reason. I'm a lousy on-air jock.
Well, I even think some of the biggest on-air talents in the world wouldn't want to hear their shift from when they were 15.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm kind of an insecure guy. Behind the scenes is what I like, and that's one of the reasons I like it, is because when you're on the air, you mess up. You can't go back. It's real time.
It's there. It's out there.
But with production, you can mess up and go back, change it before it hits the air, and it sounds like you do it perfect every time, when in reality, no, not really.
Yeah.
So I went through high school working the weekends at that station. Then when I graduated high school, went from Indianapolis down to Bloomington, Indiana. I went to college at Indiana University.
Cool.
And worked at the
nice small school you chose.
Yeah, it's kind of a family tradition. I'm the young kid and in the family, and it was like everybody else did. So like, it's, where are you going to go? I'll go there. Got down there, did the first year at the local student station, doing production, and then worked my way. There was an AM station, was kind of the town radio station, playing top 40, and landed a weekend air shift there. And just when summertime rolled around, and I was going to have to move out of my apartment, and I was running out of money and was going to have to go back home and work a part-time job somewhere. The program director approached me and said, "Hey, we're looking for a full-time production director for AM and FM. Would you be interested?" And it saved my life. I mean, it was like I would have probably been out of radio at that point if that not happened.
You would have had to get that real job.
Yeah, exactly. That's the first life-saving event in my life from having a legitimate career. But so I ended up working full-time there. It was a interesting situation because the station was really creative people, great to work for, and they knew it was staffed with a couple of college kids, so they permitted me. I had a full-time college course, but I'd do production in the morning, go to class in the afternoon, come back and finish the spots at night, and then do a weekend shift. And then that was also the time when club DJing, when disco was hot, and I worked three nights a week from 9 until 3 a.m. in some of the big clubs down there. And I still look back going, I don't know when I slept. I don't know how I got through that time, but I did, and I loved it. And that was when I got really into listening to the imaging back in, this was 79, 80. And the imaging for radio at that time was musical jingles, was station jingles. And I got to be a jingle freak big time and kind of dreamed of one day being a producer at TM Productions or Jam was another big jingle company.
Yep.
And actually met my first mentor just over the phone, never met him personally for years, and that was Ken Justice. Was the guy, he was a producer at TM that put together all the jingle demo tapes. And that's where I learned by listening to those and kind of reverse engineering them that things that happen in 2 seconds in production time when you listen to it in real time, you can spend hours putting it together and making it work just perfectly. And so I struck up an obnoxious kid on the phone to a professional production guy friendship with Ken. I probably drove him crazy. I'd call him going, "Well, did you listen to this tape, you know, that I did, and give me some advice?" And he was really nice about it and helped me out quite a bit. And believe it or not, he left TM, and just as I was graduating, I put in my resume there, and there was an opening, and my first gig out of college was what I thought was going to be my dream job, which was a jingle producer at TM.
Mm-hmm.
That opened up a whole nother world for me because they had huge 24-track recording studios. They had 3 full studios, probably 90 full-time employees at the time. And
I should know this. Were they near or in the same in Dallas?
This was when they were over on Regal Row. And I just, in fact, a couple of months ago went back for a little visit, got to go in and say hi to some of the old guys that I had known, and actually said hi to Ricky Rue while I was there. It was nice to see him. But the facilities were just top-notch at the time. I mean, it was and it gave me the chance to go from radio production thinking to learn multi-track production, the whole concept of channels of audio running through a board being mixed together in subgroups, EQing separately, not committing to. I mean, up until that point, I was working off of reel-to-reels where and firing sound effects in a commercial or a promo off of carts.
Yeah.
And there's probably lots of people right now going, "What the hell is a cart?" And
you were sort of producing stuff live to tape.
Basically. Exactly. Yeah. And getting into the multi-track world opened up a whole new world for creating sounds. So that was incredible for me. And at the same time, I was getting into creating sounds. I bought my first synthesizer just before I left Bloomington. And a little funny story there is I didn't know what I was doing, but I wanted a synthesizer. So I went to this music store, bought this used Arp Odyssey synthesizer because it was made this neat little laser sound, and got it home and suddenly realized that little laser sound was the only freaking sound I could get it to make. Turns out it was fried. That was the only thing. So I had spent a couple $100 getting it fixed and had to start learning how to program a synthesizer. And that came in handy at TM too. And just that combination of things was a real growth experience for me.
How long were you at TM?
A little over a year.
Okay.
Then unfortunately, my dad got sick back in Indiana. So I moved back to take a job with a jingle company in Indianapolis that did advertising jingles. And that was great because there was the it's when John Cougar Mellencamp was hot and his band was located there. So the head writer for the Jingle Company was his keyboard player, and the drummer the Jingle Sessions was Kenny Arnott, the drummer for Cougar. So that was kind of a wow experience.
Now you spent a little time there working on the commercial side of things versus creating radio jingles. Were there drastic differences, or were you able to kind of use the same brain power on either side of the ball there?
It depended quite a bit on the sophistication of the advertiser. Radio, I loved radio production from the standpoint of it didn't have to create revenue. It had to create interest and attention for the radio station. And that isn't always the goal of a commercial for a client. I mean, the goal of the commercial for a client is I want to make money. So you had a lot more leeway and it was a lot more creativity, a lot more, you can do a lot more, get away with a lot more doing a radio promo than a commercial with a unsophisticated commercial client. But some of the sophisticated clients, they wanted something wild and crazy. I mean, it had to deliver results. It was measurable. And I have to admit that is one thing. The promos and sweepers, you really can't quite measure, hey, did it pop the PPM up a little bit, or you can't know exactly if it was the result of that, whereas you can tell if a commercial rings the cash register. So and at that time I was one of the local DJs from the leading radio station came in to cut a commercial, and I volunteered to run the board for it, and he said, hey, Rick, we have an open for production director job, would you be interested? And I had kind of burned out on doing commercials at the times in the past. So I went, not really. I don't really want to work with the clients all that much. And he goes, no, this is just promos and sweepers. My jaw dropped because let me tell you, back that was 83, 84. In those years, radio really didn't have a separate department for creative services or for imaging. It was a term that just wasn't in existence back then.
Stations weren't really putting enough focus on their own brand, right? I mean, they would buy a jingle package,
yeah,
and otherwise it would be kind of just like dry liners all over the station, right?
Well, you can go back. I mean, it's some of the fun things to do is go back and actually listen to some of the stuff that was done. I'm even talking, in the 70s, there were some incredibly creative promotions out there. The Last Contest was one. Yeah. I mean, but most of that was focused around the big 50,000 watt blowtorches in the major markets. It was L.A. Yeah. It was Chicago. It was New York. And there wasn't the budget to do it in the other cities. But the station I ended up working for in Indianapolis, it was owned by a company called Fairbanks, and those guys. It's hard to go back and look at that because let me tell you, they were printing money. There were no stockholders. It was just one owner, and they were running on that station 19 minutes of commercials an hour. Not 19 units, but 19 minutes. And that station was number one with an 18.6 share when I was working there. So, and that was just the AM. They had the FM there, which was an incredible top 40 FM. In fact, the production, when I was production director at the AM, down the hall, the production director was a guy named Eric Edwards. who I had grown up, he's going to kill me for saying this because I always make fun of him that I grew up listening to his production. But I learned so much from listening to his production.
We'll get to your days at Hot in a bit, but is it serendipitous that he would end up as the voice there?
Well, actually, I got to give a lot of credit to the gang at MS Broadcasting because they kind of brought us all together.
Okay.
They hired Eric away from WNAP to go to their AC station. And got him over there just as Power 106 in LA was launching. And so he got sent to LA to be the production guy and do imaging for Power 106 in LA. And bear with me because there's a whirlwind of crazy stories. It's like a bad movie where everything comes together at the end here. Mm-hmm. But having worked at TM, I always loved doing freelance, so I had bought a little Akai sampler. It was when samplers first came out. Let me tell you, this thing would do a second and a half of recording. That was it, compared to what you can, put in a sampler these days.
Right, wow.
And then down the hallway replacing Eric Edwards was a guy named Brian James. So Brian and I got together and created a sweeper package, and it was really just when sweepers were first starting to happen. Jingles were just starting to wane out, and spoken sweepers were starting to happen. And so Brian and I put together a package called Digital Voice Identification, and the guys down at TM offered to market it for me. So they started selling it and marketed as if I was, they didn't really say who was doing it, and they marketed as if it was being still produced out of Dallas. And it was great because we landed, I mean, I got to produce stuff for Kiss FM in LA at the time, for Boston, for Chicago. There's some interesting major stuff that we got to do, but I was kind of behind the scenes. Well, Emmis then started launching, Power 106 was doing so well in LA that they started launching Hot 103 in New York City to do kind of a sister station to that. And Joel Sokowitz was the program director for that station in New York. Rick Cummings was the national program director for Emmis, and he was based in Indianapolis. And he was talking to me, trying to get me to come to work for Emmis. And
In Indy.
And we kept going back and forth because Fairbanks' philosophy was they had a philosophy called the golden handcuffs. God bless them. And it's almost unheard of today. But the general manager looked straight at me and he goes, "We're going to pay you more than you're worth." And my jaw dropped and he goes, "We don't want you to leave. We don't want anybody to leave. So we're always paying somebody a little bit more than the market justifies." And they did. And so it was hard to beat that salary to get me to jump to another station. So Rick kept talking to me though, and then Joel bought Digital Voice Identification for Hot and out of Dallas. So Rick and Joel got together and I don't know if this is urban myth or not, but I still love the story and I keep telling it. But Rick told Joel, he goes, "Hey, I've got somebody I want you to talk to about the production director job in New York." And Joel goes, "Well, there's a guy down in Dallas that I'm interested in." And Rick goes, "Well, I want you to talk to this guy here in Indianapolis." turned out both of them were me.
It was the same guy, right?
Yeah. So that was really cool. I got the job offer, took the job offer.
So was this at the time, I mean, you know, you say, you know, you loved the Fairbanks company and Indy's real close to home and all that. But this was a job you just simply couldn't pass up, right?
You know, I have to tell you, I'll keep using, you're going to hear the word insecure a few times during this conversation. I will tell you that I went to my program director at WIBC who was, I have been so blessed working for some awesome program directors. And the program director was Mary June Rose. She went on to program WBT in Charlotte programmed in Chicago. Phenomenal. News talk program director. And I remember sitting down with her and she ended up more as a big sister or a mom to me than anything else. And within one day I quit, then begged for my job back, quit, begged for my job back probably about six times. just because it scared me to death. And it was like, that's, you know, going to New York City. But ended up doing it. You're right. You can't pass that up.
Yeah.
I'll be really honest. I thought I was going to be there. My thought at that time, okay, go there, get it on the resume, spend 6 months, and then get out of there and go somewhere else in a smaller market and more relaxed atmosphere. I ended up in New York for over 10 years, so that gives you an idea.
That's what I was going to say. So we've gotten to New York. I think a lot of people that, you know the Rick Allen name, they know you for a multitude of things, but, you know, famous work that you did at Hot in New York. And how long had Hot 103 been on before you got there?
About 6 months. They launched with the digital voice identification package and started looking for a production director. But it was about 6 months. I got there in December, and they'd been on the air for a few months.
And what voice did they launch with? Because as you said, you know, stations were going a little away from the jingles, and actually, I'm going to get to this in a minute. But you know, urban stations weren't using as much of a jingle, right? As much of a jingle package.
No, for the most part, we did a couple of over the years that I was there, we did a couple of ramp ups that were jingle-ish from both Jam and from TM. But for the most part, it was strictly voiceover sweepers. And it's another amazing Indiana fact. The voice, the major voice for the IDs was Chuck Riley, who had originally done afternoons at WIBC back in Indianapolis. So the voice talent that was back in Indy when I was there was ended up being the big national talent later on. But I mean, and we didn't know it, and mm-hmm. so we kind of all were really good friends and knew each other. So and then the secondary voice, the promo voice at Hot was Eric Edwards. So the three of us had kind of had interaction over the years. So
we heard both those voices in that demo I played to launch this part of the episode, right?
Both those are the voices you heard. Other than listeners, artists, and that sort of thing. But yeah.
But I think everybody can pick out Eric Edwards pretty well, and Chuck Riley is the other main voice.
Yes. Yeah. Chuck is the kind of larger than life movie trailer voice, and he just passed away recently. And then Eric, Eric started on that radio station and is still on that radio station.
I'm curious because that's why I was asking. So he was on the air on that station when you started there, and this is in, 86, 87, 88?
Yeah, 86.
86. So, I mean, is this, where else is that true? I mean, what other station is using the same voice for that long?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean,
we may not even know specifically, but can you think of even a possibility?
Long pause? No.
Yeah.
No, I can't.
It's crazy. And he works so well on that station in any time. I mean, he's never
gone through,
not fit in there.
When you think about the format transition between dance music, pop dance, into hard street hip hop,
that pop leaning side too.
Yep. He can do it.
Man, it's pretty. I guess I didn't. I just sort of guessed he might have been on there when you started, but I thought, you'd say, no, we picked him up in the late 90s. He didn't work back now, but of course he was there.
No, that was. I credit.
It's wild.
I credit the geniuses at Emmis for that. They picked Chuck and Eric both and stuck with them through the whole time.
Yeah. Oh, so that's great. So you get to New York City. Now, did you move to the city? Did you move to Manhattan?
The station was actually in Queens, was in the Kaufman Osoria soundstage, which was a huge old ancient movie studio. And which is actually, when I was there, they were filming every week, they filmed The Cosby Show there. So I'd walk out on, I think it was Wednesday nights when they filmed, when they did the taping, and you'd walk by the huge line of people wanting to go in. You kind of sneak by everybody. But the station was actually two floors underground in this huge, vast area, and the place had a commissary for the movie people and everything. So there were days when, in the wintertime, when I'd pull into the parking lot, walk in when the sun hadn't come up yet, eat lunch in the commissary, which was in the basement with no windows, go back to work, and then when I'd leave, the sun would be down, and I never saw the sun the whole day. Those were some freaky times.
Yeah. That's like Vegas times.
But I actually moved. I lived in Douglaston, New York, which is out just right on the Queens Long Island border when I first got there, and that was still a shock going from Indianapolis to that. It was an adjustment, and the station eventually moved into studios at 37th and Broadway in New York, in the city, in Manhattan, and that's when I ended up getting a house in over in New Jersey. Kind of in an area.
What part of Jersey did you live in?
In Emerson, which is northern in Bergen County. So I actually, my place backed up on the Hackensack Golf Course in a big woods. So it felt like kind of, Midwest home. And then I'd get on the bus in the morning and spend an hour sitting there commuting into the city, through the Queens Midtown Tunnel and boom, through the Midtown Tunnel and into the real world, into the big city.
It's funny. I used to do radio back there, and it's funny if people listening have never actually been to Jersey. There's parts of it that are very, very suburban. It's you'd be very surprised at how just kind of nice the towns can feel.
But I got to give a shout out to Jersey, because let me tell you, when I first moved there, when I first moved to New York, my only perception of Jersey was toxic waste dumps and smelly factories. And when someone told me, Rick, you would love living in Jersey, I went, there's no way. And I drove over there and checked it out, and I fell in love with it. And it's beautiful. I mean, Connecticut, Jersey, that whole area, to this day, I still, when I go back there, I have to spend time out of the city and just visiting friends back in the suburbs.
And so you're in 37th and Broad at that point. If I'm not mistaken, they're downtown now. Because, I mean, I was there. I visited Dom Nero there.
They moved just after I left. They relocated stations down. Yep, downtown.
So, all right. So you're in New York. You're working at Hot. And, I mean, I guess I'll just let you, you know, tell us a couple stories about that.
Well, an incredible support. They were open to buying at the time, most radio stations didn't have multi-track tape machines. They installed an 8-track Atari tape machine, a really nice recording console. I got an Emulator 2 sampler, which was state of the art at the time. And that even evolved. I mean, the technology, Emma's put money into technology to help creativity with every step. Through the years, I ended up with one of the first radio stations in America with New England Digital Synclaver system and Post-Pro system. And I was kind of a beta tester for that. Hmm. And that was if I remember right, the total system ran about $300,000. And they put it in. And we were able to do some incredible sounds because they spent the money. But they also encouraged creativity. I mean, it was a great environment.
For some people, myself included, can you explain a little more about what you just said?
Synclaver. New England Digital was started by people that came out of Dartmouth, their electronics program at Dartmouth College, which is pretty highbrow. And back in the day when you had to play a piano, if you wanted a piano song, then samplers started happening, and you could play a keyboard and recreate any sound. Well, the Synclaver was the first that you could do that on an orchestra level. And it was really the technology at the time. I mean, now you could do that with your iPhone, but at the time,
how did it work? Did it have recorded samples inside and it just played them back, or was it, how did it work?
It had a huge 12-inch hard drive laser discs of different sample bits. And it had a tremendous amount of RAM for the time. And so it would load, you could recall programs similar to what you can do now with a sampler on Pro Tools or Adobe.
But it would have to seek to the part of the disc that the sound you want is on?
Then it would load it into RAM. You'd have to wait for a little bit, but then you'd have it in RAM. And then it was then that we kind of thought outside the box and said, you know what, we can add other things other than just music and, you know, other than a violin or a snare drum into this. We started putting voices in there, and we started putting, trash cans being smashed. And so you started to be able to manipulate natural sounds to make them sound unnatural, which was my first experience at understanding that the human mind, even though you're mangling something, can somewhat recognize that natural part of the sound, and it becomes subconsciously, I think, more open to getting the attention of somebody. The brain perks up a little bit when they hear that.
When did the transition to Hot 97.1 go? It was after your time there?
No. That was my time, and I've been doing this so long that the years get fuzzy. And there's gonna be a million people out there going, "You idiot! It was 19, whatever."
Well, or generally, and tell us what, I don't know if there's a story there. I'm just trying to find out if there's a fun story involved with that, or was it just a matter of
absolutely?
Swapping?
No, it was an absolutely incredible time because it was pretty much unheard of. Emmis had bought stations from the NBC chain, and so the 103 frequency was on the World Trade Center. The transmitter was downtown, and there was a lot of multipath in the transmission in the city, so the signal would fade out in some areas that you didn't want it to fade out in.
Mm-hmm.
And so the 97 frequency was on the Empire State Building. So the much better signal covering the city.
Yeah.
So they wanted to swap it. So they took the country station that was WINY at the time on 97 and put it on 103 and popped Hot 103 up to 97, which sounds simple, but when you think about it, I had to go back and recreate every single sweeper, and and not only that, the promotions department, which did an awesome job, had to get everybody's attention, going, hey, you know, we're not disappearing, we're moving, and so there was a lot of effort put into the promotion, and the actual switch was a blast. We had the Wheel of Fortune was a big thing at the time, and we had Vanna White spin the wheel and make the switch, which was kind of fun. It was an incredible time.
And so, of course, the one thing I wanted to bring up, in fact, I can put the link to this. You sent me the link. I can put that on this. That'll be on the show notes page, actually, as you're listening now. I'll just let you tell the story of, is it the phone lady session?
Rick Cummings and Doyle Rose tracked down, and you got to put everything, there's so much of this has to be put into perspective of the time era.
Yeah,
because
true.
Back
411 was humongous.
Yeah, there was everybody dialed 411, and there was AT&T had one 411 operator, one voice recorded, one digital voice, and it was a lady in Pennsylvania named Ramona Lenny, and an awesome voice actress and what I found out to be an incredibly nice person, and we brought her over on the train and picked her up and brought her to the studio and sat her down, and she recorded all the numbers. You know, the number you have reached is and disconnected, and we put it together as a radio promotion where if you go to the link on the show notes page, there's a couple of samples of how at the time we were battling with Z100 pretty heavily. And so we had a one that went, the number you've reached, Z100, has been disconnected. The new number is 103.5. So yeah, we kind of poked at a lot of the competition that way. No, she was great. In fact, you actually hear some outtakes. There was one where her stomach growled really loud. And you know, she sounds really natural, and all of a sudden you hear the growl, and I had to go, hey, you know, one more time, I got to edit that. So that's, and those are floating around the country. A lot of people, in fact, actually a couple of other competing production libraries have ripped that off and put them in there.
I was going to say, that has to be one of the most copied bits, you know, ever. I mean, you got the lady to come in and record it, while someone like me at some podunk station in, you know, middle America, I just call up the phone system and just use what I can. You know what I mean? I just start dialing numbers in and have her say, you know, that number doesn't exist. But you actually got the lady.
And she was a sweetheart. So that was a great, great experience.
Yeah, I recommend people check out that link, show notes page. It'll be labeled Phone Lady Session, but it's fun. And then you can hear the full deal you put together on there. I believe you have that on that page, separate from the dialer. But
yep.
Yeah, just great stuff.
The producers,